cliffcentral.com.
That's very nice. That's Sting with If You Love Someone, Set Them Free. cliffcentral.com. Thursday morning, we have a busy lineup today of really interesting stuff to talk about. And I think if you have anything to add, we're trying to connect that phone. Any luck on that front, Mbulelo, to see whether there's hate mail for you yet? Mbulelo.
Ah. I just presume the hate exists. I don't need it to be confirmed.
Well, we would like to hear it loud and clear because, you know, people have got to have a voice, Mbulelo.
As the old technology people used to say, our technicians are working on it. We apologize for the inconvenience.
Please apologize to the stakeholders.
The stakeholders.
All right. Well, we have some stakeholders in the discussion around the Burning Platform this morning. And there's always stuff to discuss in the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's every single week. And the people who we're talking to today include Mighty Jamie, who has made a triumphant return to the Burning Platform, a long time in the making. We haven't had the multi-award-winning international debating and public speaking champion and coach Mighty Jamie on the show, but he's part of the lineup this morning, I'm delighted to say. So,
and we're quite happy to have him wearing a duck on the show.
Yes, that's excellent. Yes. Good for you. Good for you, Jamie. And then Canthan Pillay, who's our returning champion, back again for more discussions around all those things that affect our lives and the things that people are most interested in. So, gentlemen, a quiet week, huh? Not much happening in the world.
No, coronavirus seems to have suddenly gone away. Yeah. Did you notice?
It's not the priority. Social
distancing doesn't matter. You know, it's not like we're going to be killing people by walking on the beach anymore. No, it's actually far more important that we be out there shoulder to shoulder, showing our solidarity with the coronavirus. Yep, well done.
Well, I mean, we'll get into that in a second. Jamie, how are you doing, man? We haven't spoken to you in a while.
I'm good. I mean, everyone's under, you know, some version of restriction because of this particular crisis. But this week, at least, there's been a change in the way things are working, and that's altering how everyone interacts. So we'll see how it plays out. But I'm okay. I'm okay. At an individual level, I'm okay.
Well, guys, can we just quickly get to the lockdown? We moved to level 3 this week, and Canthan, last week when we spoke, you know, you weren't particularly optimistic that very much would change. It turns out that you're right, because nothing much has changed. There were more people, though, heading back to work, and there was a very important court ruling, which I think we need to talk about. So do you want to kick off with how you're feeling 1 week later, Canthan?
Yeah, I think the crucial thing apropos of the court ruling, Gareth, is that, yes, we have had a court ruling, and the court ruling made some significant points. Actually, this is the second significant court ruling, because remember that we had the earlier court ruling in the Collins-Corso case,
right?
Which to my mind, was far more significant, because that was putting restraints in terms of the government's ability to inflict violence upon the populace. And from a constitutional law point of view, I think that that was a far more significant judgment. This week's judgment, fundamental problem that I have with it is that the starting point around it is to say that, yes, the lockdown is rational, but there are particular things in terms of the way in which it was implemented that were irrational. And more to the point, we are not striking down those irrational things at this point. We are going to wait and give the minister 14 days to actually fix this stuff. Now, the problem that I have with this is that it then gives the minister 14 days to come up with different regulations that are similar in terms of the net impact. And at that level, I don't believe that the judgment is as significant as people make it out to be, and is unlikely to change anything significant in the short term.
Well, Jamie has very different opinions to some of the ones that we've expressed here on the Burning Platform so far. In fact, he thinks that maybe policing was too soft and that the ANC wasn't willing to take a tougher stance during the lockdown. Jamie, do you want to kick it off there and tell us what else you disagree with that's been going on in terms of the lockdown?
Well, I think I want to start off by saying that the two court decisions were actually very important, because you do need to make sure that individual liberties are respected And I think that the army was indeed overreaching when they were like making people frog march, when they were assaulting people, and basically even violating what the rules were, you know, about being in your yard, etc. So that's important. It's important that that decision was made. It's also important that the courts right now made a very clear proclamation that any limitations of people's rights need to be in line with the Constitution. They need to be rational, and they need to be linked directly to the principle under which they've been, promulgated. So all of those things are very important. When I reflect on this particular lockdown, I think that what happened was we had a very laissez-faire application of the actual lockdown at the beginning. And that actually is what allowed for what some people are calling hotspots to actually emerge. I mean, at the very beginning, it was clear that the suburbs of KZN, the suburbs of Johannesburg, the suburbs of Cape Town were some of the leading, clusters for COVID-19. But there wasn't really much police presence in those areas. There wasn't much enforcement of the actual lockdown. So what we saw is that people were clandestinely visiting each other. They were clandestinely not really adhering to the spirit and letter of the lockdown. And I think that was a contributing factor to why we are continuing to see a rise. And when you move away from the suburbs and then you start looking at how did this move from one side of the South African divide to the other, we obviously see that it happened through that interface of the retail sector, where now people who are working in retail were exposed to the virus because of people who had it within the suburbs. And I think that
that's not true. I mean, we have someone called Jane who works for us, and I know this is anecdotal evidence, but there's lots more evidence if you're looking for it in terms of videos that have been circulating since the beginning of lockdown, level 5 even, that the townships have been a law unto themselves during this time. And although the police and army presence there has probably been significantly higher than in any other part of the country, most people in the townships have been carrying on. Now, Jane, who works for us, said to me and Alex, there's been no regulation. There's been no law. People have been doing whatever they wanted. They've been carrying on about their daily business. They've been playing in the streets with the kids anyway. The adults have been either trying to go to the shops and get work done, or they've been carrying on with their day. In fact, we had Unati Kwaza on not so long ago, who said that in Khayelitsha, things were exactly the same in lockdown as they were outside of lockdown. So I don't know why you feel that the suburbs have been doing their own thing. If anything, all the Karens in the suburbs have been telling on each other to keep themselves in their homes.
Well, it's a streetlight effect, basically, guys, because the testing has been taking place in those suburbs. And the reason why the testing has been taking place in those suburbs is because people in those suburbs have access to medical aid. And so we have the streetlight effect where suddenly it's a suburb spreading infection. No, the suburbs are where we're detecting the infections because of the fact that that's where we're looking.
Well, I think that two things can be true at the same time. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that there were very low levels of observance of the lockdown in the townships of South Africa. That's correct. But when I'm looking at the initial response, I think that the initial response was meant to be directed at the places which were currently hotspots at the time. I mean, just to add to what I said earlier, I think that one of the other gaps that existed is that there wasn't widespread testing of people within the suburbs of South Africa early on in the lockdown. There was random testing in places like Alex, sometimes in Soweto, but those places at that particular time didn't even have a single identified case, where you had hundreds of cases identified in places like Ilovo, in places like Rosebank in Johannesburg, for instance, but there wasn't any testing there. And it seemed illogical to ignore those hotspots to go and do like some kind of a community test in Alex just to make sure there's nothing there at the time.
So, Jamie,
so I think that if there had been a different response earlier on, because at the beginning, sure, you're right, people were walking around in Alex, but there wasn't any risk at that point because there wasn't any community spread at that particular moment.
Yeah,
but where there was community
spread. My point is just to say that I think the townships did it right. They carried on with life. They, even if the disease was spreading, it's not as dangerous as anyone said it was. And I think that this whole lockdown has been a complete sham and a waste of time. And government are now painted themselves into a corner. And it appears on all the latest evidence that the whole coronavirus epidemic all over the world is a much bigger deal because governments made poor decisions in the wake of it. And it's not nearly as dangerous and deadly as everybody said it was going to be. The townships were cleverer than the suburbs. They didn't board themselves up, stay indoors, only go to the shops for food, report their neighbors, not go for walks in the morning, all of that crap. They carried on with their lives as usual. And it might just turn out that the townships are more resilient as a result of that. And the township economies last longer as a result of it too. I think this lockdown's been a complete sham.
Well, I know that's what you think.
Guys, can we move the discussion away from whether the lockdown was a sham or not? Because I think one of the things that we become obsessed with as a nation is that we keep focusing on, is the lockdown working? Is it not working?
Okay.
You know, is the government doing a good job? Let's remember the reason why we had a lockdown in the first place. This entire flatten the curve thing. And what did we mean by that? We wanted to buy time for the healthcare services to be able to get their act together so that when the infections started rolling in, then we would be in a position to deal with those infections. And that was always the purpose of the lockdown everywhere in the world. Nowhere in the world was it the purpose of the lockdown to prevent the disease from spreading.
Right.
Because the end game was always, this is going to spread, people are going to get infected, people are going to die. But what we want is the ability to save more lives, and the way in which we save more lives is by making sure that our healthcare facilities are able to actually deal with this. Now we have the scenario where we've gone through this process so far. Our healthcare services are not overwhelmed, certainly not in terms of the private sector. In fact, a lot of those private sector hospitals are in danger of shutting down because their regular source of income from things like other types of surgery or the fact that doctors have offices that are based in these hospitals and that income stream is now not coming in. So the integrity of the private healthcare system is now under threat as a direct result of the fact that you literally have empty hospitals where people are not being treated, but there are empty beds. Yes, you know, there are ICU beds available, but then the rest of the beds, which actually pay the bills for those hospitals, are not working. So the questions that we really need to be asking at this point, do we have enough data right now that's giving us a sense of the extent to which our hospitals are in a position to cope for a sudden spike in terms of numbers? We do need to look at things like the Western Cape, which has had a higher amount of testing per capita than any other part of the country. Is there evidence out there that we've actually passed the first wave of infection? Because there is going to be a second wave of infection that kicks in. All of this is what we need to be talking about. It needs to be driven by numbers. It needs to be driven by data. And not a question of whether it's the fault of Karen in the middle class or whether it's the fault of Ben who is sitting out in Alex. Really, guys, you know,
I've got my axe to grind with the Karen, so I'm sorry I keep bringing it up. But, okay, and also this idea that somehow there's a difference between the way that it spreads in the townships and the suburbs and that's the most important thing. This virus is non-discriminatory. If it gets into a community, it's going to spread around. And obviously in the suburbs, there's a little bit more space between people, so that may have an effect too. Let's just turn our attention to what's going on in America and how that's affected us here, because social media this week has undoubtedly, and in a massive online campaign.
But before we do that, Gareth, before we do that, there's something that I want to just dive in on a little bit, just to push back a little bit on one of the things that I think doesn't get talked about enough.
Okay.
You know, the paradigm that South Africa adopted for handling this virus is actually not one that we examine sufficiently. The paradigm being, we're going to lock down to build capacity. That's one approach, but it's not the only way to deal with this particular virus. We saw New Zealand, Slovenia, Australia, South Korea, Taiwan take different approaches to this virus. And their approach was, we are going to take every measure to make sure that we actually reduce the load of the virus in our societies so that we can reopen. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we had one choice and this is the only choice. So I think that sometimes we've allowed government officials to push a particular narrative, one which was never realistic to begin with, this idea that we're going to get to a magical position where we have enough capacity to deal with a widespread community spread of this particular virus, which I don't think is feasible. And we're seeing that in the Western Cape right now, where they're saying we don't think we've got enough beds. They were never going to have enough beds. The challenge is we didn't take the measures that we needed to actually try to reduce the amount of viral load in our society. And we took a middle of the road approach, and we tried to be, you know, some version of pragmatic, where we accepted that we're going to lose a lot of lives. Let's just make sure we can do so in the most manageable way. That wasn't the only option that existed. But anyway, we are where we are now. But I think it's important for us to say, look, that wasn't the only way to deal with this particular crisis. There are other examples. Of course, resources play a factor, but we didn't have to go the Sweden and the UK route necessarily. I mean, we're kind of on the UK route, not Sweden. But we had options besides those particular options.
Yeah, I think it's caught lots of governments on the back foot, though, and people were really just doing whatever they thought was appropriate. And I even hinted at that in my open letter to Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, that I think that their intention was obviously to do the best job they could. There's no government that said, all right, this is a great opportunity for us to screw the people of our countries yet again. I think they genuinely tried to react with the most compassionate and thoughtful and practical means of dealing with this disease that they possibly could. Unfortunately, there are going to be costs to all of those decisions, and those costs may only come around a couple of months after we've dealt with this pandemic. But I do think there will also be costs for the government and for the NCCC in the political future of the ANC. And I wonder what's going to happen there once unions start to calculate the cost of job losses, once we've discovered just what this means for unemployed people. I think there will be costs, and I'm sure that those will be substantial.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the cost. And I think what we're seeing with the reopening is that the mines, for example, have become their own hotspots and epicenters. And that was always inevitable, because going underground, the kind of machinery they used to go underground, the kind of living conditions in the mining sector have not been dealt with for a very long time. So it's going to be interesting to observe the political outcomes of this particular reopening for the ANC and for the other parties which are around these kind of issues. Because right now, the EFF has become more vocal. They were very quiet at the beginning, but they've become more vocal as the economy has reopened. And it seems very likely that they'll be able to sponge up a lot of the support from people who feel like the ANC has put their lives at risk or directly led to their loss of lives. I think when we start getting to the 1,000 mark in terms of deaths, we're going to start seeing a more tense conversation, a more somber conversation around this particular issue, because it's going to start hitting home more and more. Because as the numbers increase, more and more people are going to have to either go to funerals or be aware of somebody in their neighborhood who's passed away. And that's kind of changed the tone. For many people, this is still something that's distant, still something they're seeing on social media and on TV. But when it starts coming to next door, when it starts coming into your yard, mm-hmm. that totally changes the atmosphere.
Yeah, but that's, Jamie, that's been the narrative from the get-go. You know, it's like, yeah, you guys are taking it easy right now because you don't know. It is going to hit us. It's going to snot clap us and all of that type of stuff. But let's talk about that 1,000 figure. That 1,000 figure is important for me in another context. And the figure that I want to talk about is 1,003. And the reason why 1,003 is important is because, sorry, guys, you know, how did I get this so wrong? It's 1,004, not 1,003. Okay. In 2019, 1,004 people died in the United States, fatally shot by police. In 2019, 1,004 people were fatally shot by police, mm-hmm. of which 235 were black.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's take that 1,004. What's the population of the U.S.?
About 330 million.
370 million is the figure that the CIA World Factbook goes with. So let's run with that figure, okay? So we have 1,004 deaths out of 370 million people, of which 235 of those 1,004 deaths happen to be black. And we do a very simple division, and that's 0.0000026 of the population that is being killed every year by systemic racism, yeah. for fuck's sake.
So what,
can we talk? Can we talk
so
about?
So what are you the, saying? Are you saying this is a stupid narrative? Are you saying it's not?
I'm saying that we are fucking idiots. We can't count. Can we just get this straight? Okay.
I don't think that's the issue, though. I don't think the issue is.
Yeah, but no. We always come back to this. We always come back to this. But my basic point is that if you have a scenario where 1,004 people are killed by police in a country of 370 million people, of which 235 happen to be black, more than 50% of them happen to be white, and the rest of them happen to be Hispanic. And instead of talking about the essential problem that the Americans have, which comes back to a problem that we have as well. Do you guys remember Andries Tatane?
Yes.
Okay, talk to me about Andries Tatane. Was it systemic racism that killed Andries Tatane?
He was brutally killed by police in a massive use of force and monopolistic violence by the state against a man who'd really done nothing more criminal than should have landed him in a jail cell at most for a few days.
He was trying to get water.
He was protesting for water as well.
He was trying to get, and that community still doesn't have water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even his wife. She died in an accident trying to get water.
Exactly. Why do we not talk about that as systemic racism? Because it isn't systemic racism. It is incompetence on the part of policing. It is incompetence on the part of policing. I'm going to say this over and over again. And every woke fuckhead who turns around and tries to say, no, there are systemic injustices, we are never going to fix it. The only way we will fix it is by actually concentrating on the fact that our police processes are absolutely fucked, because we insist that violence on the part of police is going to be the first way in which we deal with any particular scenario. And if we are turning around and saying that policing the world over right now is stuffed up, and we actually need to build a way in which law enforcement can take place without violating basic human rights, we are always going to have this divide. People are always going to turn around and say, no, the problem is white versus black.
But I suspect Jamie might have additional points to add to yours and maybe some disagreement. Jamie, go ahead.
So there's two things I want to say, is that when we're looking at, even looking at last year's statistics, if you have 1,004 people being killed by the police and 200 plus coming from one particular community, the African-American community, that's 20% of all deaths being from the African community, African-American community, which is disproportionate to the number of African-Americans who live in America, because I think there's about 33 million, if my numbers are not mistaken. So it's slightly under 10%. But
you are absolutely right. But if you are absolutely right. But I'm going to climb in on that point and say, if we're going to talk statistics at that level, Jamie, then we also need to talk about the fact that a disproportionate number of criminality is committed by that very same community. We have to talk about the fact that 77% of homicides are committed by that community. We have to talk about the fact that more than 50% of violent crime is committed by that committee. That community.
So if we're
going to drill down to numbers at that level, then let's drill down to numbers by talking in terms of perps as well as victims.
So it's. I think we need to be very blunt, but also think long term in our conversations about African American communities and how they have been treated in America specifically. So, going back to the original point, and not to disregard any of the contributions you've made, Kanthan, is that when you see double the number of deaths coming from one particular community, that already raises a red flag. Now, you're not wrong to say that violent policing tactics, the militarization of the police in America especially, is something that has contributed to this. And what studies there have shown is that in places where there are rules around minimal force being used by the police, where violence is being offered as a last resort, in terms of the department's rules, you see less of these kind of instances, what we saw last week with George Floyd. So that's not incorrect, everything you've said. However, the conversation moves from the specific instances and from the violent and militarization of the police to a more broader conversation around the nature of policing in Black communities and what people commonly refer to as the school prison industrial complex. The way that society has undermined and undercut African-American communities in America is such that the schooling they've received is very poor. The economic opportunities they've received are very poor. A lot of the fathers in that community have been absent because they've been arrested. Drugs were dumped into that community. Violent drug laws were imposed on them, where things like, you know, selling marijuana or consuming marijuana could actually lead to you being in jail for protracted periods of time. Removing male father figures from society, what did that lead to? It led to a situation where you have a lot of gangs dominating the culture on the street.
I'm in 100% agreement with you on all of these things. But that has nothing. That has got nothing to do with 1,004 police deaths across a country of 370 million people, of which 235 people happen to be black. And the problem we're trying to fix is brutality among police.
All right, but,
and the way in which you go about fixing that has got nothing to do with the history of slavery in the United States. It's got nothing to do with the fact that you have people who are now taking to the streets and are literally demolishing the very lives that have been built up by those communities. Because the primary victims of these riots have been black. The buildings that have been burnt down in those communities. The shops that have been torched have been small black-owned businesses that have been built up over generations and are now lost forever. The fallout in terms of poverty that is going to result as a primarily because of these riots is going to take generations to fix. And why? Because of the fact that we have one person gets murdered and people attribute it to race instead of police brutality, which we should be fixing.
Well, I think the reason why you see the kind of anger that you see in the first instance is that this is something that African Americans have been saying happens and is ignored and denied by the police. So in this particular instance, the video footage showed exactly what they're saying has been happening, whether it's Michael Brown. The Michael Brown killing was the killing which triggered the formation of Black Lives Matter. In that instance, there was a lot of contestation about what actually happened and how that police officer killed Michael Brown and what Michael Brown was doing. But in the instance of George Floyd, you had a video taped instance where the policeman suffocated somebody for nine minutes almost, using a tactic that was not approved, and suffocated him. And in that instance, when I haven't even finished watching that video, I was not able to do it. But in that instance, those who were able to finish watching it walked away saying, one, this is infuriating and it's outrageous. But two, it actually proves what we've been talking about all along around the police treatment of African Americans. But when you zoom out a little bit more, the conversation about policing for African Americans is that the police have been targeting them in ways that they don't target other people. I mean, it's not a secret that organized crime has been rife in America
again,
for a while.
Again, I'm going to drill down into figures on this point. And remember that in the U.S., unlike our country, you actually have very accurate police statistics where people drill down into the minutiae of what actually goes on. And do you know that black cops are 300% more likely to fire upon black people than white policemen in the United States?
But the numbers of the police in America...
I'm not going to dispute it because I'm not looking at the statistics. I'm looking at those statistics. And yes, it's important that we look at this stuff because people want to drill on statistics that support their argument. And I look at statistics that don't support my argument. And that's the crucial point that I'm trying to make is that if you are trying to say that it's racism is the problem, then it would be black policemen would be less likely to be firing upon their own peer communities than white policemen. In fact, white policemen consistently are more likely to show restraint. And that's why when we keep coming back to this question of Floyd's murder, we have to ask ourselves, is this racism or is this systemic police brutality on the part of a handful?
You know,
so there's something that I want to say, Gareth, before we go on or before we even shift the question. That statistic is a misleading statistic, and I'll tell you why. In most policing communities, African Americans actually are less than 5% of the actual police force. And in spaces where they've had African Americans constituting 35% of the police force. They've seen lower levels of arrests in African-American communities broadly. So even if you say African-American cops are three times more likely to shoot at other African-Americans, that doesn't actually negate the fact that there's not even really enough of them to begin with. And
what is the race of the Minneapolis police chief?
Well, I mean, that, you know,
what is the race of the Minneapolis police chief?
That's not relevant to the point.
No,
the
it point, is relevant. You have no, a black no, police not. Chief in Minneapolis.
But the policeman who killed George Floyd was not an African American policeman. The point I'm making is it's not an accurate point to say, look, the black African American cops are three times more likely to shoot at other African Americans when there's less than 5% of them in the police force. And it doesn't negate the existence of anti-black attitudes in the majority of the police force, which are demonstrated by the way that they profile black people in the neighborhoods where they profile them, where it's demonstrated in the kind of laws that America has promulgated, which target and discriminate against African Americans. You know, when we look at police profiling, it's very common that black people will be stopped and searched for simply being in neighborhoods right. where they are deemed not but, to but have
all of that
access
is,
to.
Jamie, all of that's relevant, of course, to the bigger discussion around racism. But in this case, we've now got the cop who committed this revolting and heinous deed. He's in jail and he's going to be tried. And it seems to me the authorities have taken the necessary steps to deal with this on an individual basis. I mean, nobody in the whole of America has stood up and said, no, George Floyd deserved this, you know. So what are we fighting? Who are these? Where are these enemies? And I know that there are different kinds of racism, right? There's the overt kind and there's the much more insidious kind that people pretended, you know, like celebrities are bailing out rioters, essentially, with their money to try and appear to be on the side of Black Lives Matter. But in this case, could the authorities have done any better? They arrested this man immediately, this police officer. He's going to go on trial. He's in custody at the moment. And everybody's upset, but it doesn't seem that anyone's offering solutions as to how we can actually beat this in the long run so that we can stop this from happening again. How do we do that? How do we get past this one incident?
Well, I think there's two things that we need to be cognizant of. You can have a trigger moment for protests, but the protests generally become broader than the incident itself. So the arrest of Derek Chauvin is not necessarily going to be something that stops the actual protesters. So what are the two issues that are critical here? Number one is the systemic police brutality that African-American communities have been complaining about. And number two is the issue of the school prison industrial complex.
But okay, both of those things, Jamie, seem to me to be entirely theoretical and not supported by the statistics which Canton has
just
given us.
So let's look at some statistics.
Making it up, and so are the people. No.
I want to give you the statistics so that we are grounded in statistics. There's nothing wrong with statistics. There are 2.3 million.
No, hang on. You just said that there was something wrong with statistics.
I said that there's something wrong with misleading statistics. I said that looking at the behavior of 5%. No. You see, whenever we're doing statistical analysis, it's very important for us to check whether those statistics are misleading or accurate statistics. I mean, that's general advice I would give to any listener.
No, statistics are either correct or not.
The conclusions drawn from the statistics can be misleading if you're not looking at the holistic sample.
I said black policemen are three times more likely to fire upon their own community than white policemen.
So now the conclusion this is what you said. You said it's not racism. You see, that's a conclusion that you're drawing from the data. And you need to look at the behavior of the 95% of the police force, which is non-black. Now, the statistics I want to bring to your attention when I'm talking about the prison industrial complex specifically is that there are 2.3 million prisoners in America as things stand right now. A disproportionate amount of people are incarcerated when you compare the global populations in terms of other countries and how many people they imprison. A large number of the prison population is African American, 2/3, in fact. And those are statistics that we can check. So when people then say, listen, something is wrong with the fact that over 1 million people in the prison complex are black, when the black community is only 10% of the national population, it means that something structurally has happened at a policy level, at a government level, that has created a pathway for black people to end up in prisons and not in other spaces where they can self-actualize and enjoy the American dream. So, Gareth,
what is your supposition for that reason?
So it's because of racist discriminatory policies, especially if you look at the places where what is it called? Upward mobility is accessed. So even though the case which led to the desegregation of schools was in 1954, when that case was actually rolled out. I can't remember the name right now, but that historical
case. It was Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes, Brown versus Board of Education. And she actually passed away last year. So in Brown versus Board of Education, there was a de jure announcement that schools would not be segregated anymore. But the de facto reality in many of American states is that schools remain segregated. In fact, last year there were studies
you're basically saying that the civil rights movement's achieved nothing over the last 40 to 50 years. Is that your point?
I think that if you look at the de jure, as in the legal framework, they achieved a lot. Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP, they achieved a lot on paper. But on the ground, those things were not translated. Because you see, you can have a law, but if resources are not channeled.
No, sorry, Jamie, I'm going to climb in again at this point. Because this critical race theory bullshit that keeps propping up fails to take into account the significant progress that black people have made over generations. But let me drill down.
Hang on, Jamie. Are you saying there's no progress by black Americans?
So when we're measuring progress, we have to comparatively measure it, right? African Americans may be having a better quality of life than the average person in Togo or Zimbabwe, but we have to compare them with their peers in America. If they're falling behind their peers,
hold on a second. If I take what you just said about black people in prisons, then you must be a massive Donald Trump supporter, because he's just made rules that free more black people from prisons than any former president. Is that not helpful?
Well, I mean, the conclusion is not it doesn't flow from the premise. So it's very helpful for someone.
So you don't support Donald Trump doing what he did?
No. I said, you see, you're making it seem as if I agree with the policy decision.
You brought up prisons.
Gareth, I don't want this to be a question of
without supporting the guy.
Now, we don't need to talk about whether JB supports Donald Trump or not, because that's not really, this is not germane to the discussion. But yes, I want to drill down again into figures, because, you know, Gareth, I'm big on figures. And so Jamie says correctly that there's a disproportionate number of African Americans who are incarcerated. Now, you take the U.S.'s 75 biggest counties. African Americans commit 62% of robberies, 57% of murders, 45% of assaults, and they make up 15% of the population in those counties. Okay, so is there a disproportionate number of people who are incarcerated? Yes. But is it true that there's a disproportionate number of criminality that comes from there? Yes. Now, we can talk about the systemic problems that result in those communities being more prone to committing crimes. And I'm very happy to have that discussion, because that is a real discussion. But if we are drawing a correlation between why people are incarcerated versus criminality, we have to talk about those figures. In New York City, let's talk about New York City specifically. 75% of all shootings are perpetrated by African Americans. 70% of all robberies are perpetrated by African Americans. And 66% of all violent crime is perpetrated by African Americans, even though in New York City they are 23% of the population. Every year, more whites and Hispanics die from police homicides than blacks. 12% of white and Hispanic homicide deaths were due to police officers. 4% of black homicide deaths were a result of police officers.
So then why are people why are people so disproportionately upset about what they've just seen in America in the last 8 days?
Let me drill down to a more important figure, okay? 40% of cop killers are black. A police officer is 18 and a half times more likely to be killed by a black person than a cop killing an unarmed black person. These are all real numbers, Jamie, and I'm not drawing any inferences from them. I am putting these out there.
Okay, they so let's have a conversation numbers. About those numbers. Let's. I'm not one who's going to dispute numbers that are clear and verifiable. What I want to say is the conversation. Remember, the question was, why is the arrest of Derek Chauvin not enough? And because the issues that are being raised are, number one, police brutality that targets African-American communities disproportionately. This is why the rage was so much, because for many people, they're like, we've been telling
and
you
again,
about
again, I'm saying
this
that my figures dispute that fact. Repeat
no,
the
figures,
same thing over
your figures,
and again.
Your figures prove that there's a disproportionate amount of African-Americans. But your point that you, or the numbers that you stated right now, speak to the fact that African-Americans also commit more crime. And I want to discuss this because it speaks to the second issue, which is the prison industrial complex, Garrett, and why people are complaining about this. Now, granted, there's more crime that is coming out of certain communities in America, but you've got to then do a zoom out perspective and say, why are there so many crimes happening here? Number one, in the early 80s, drugs were dumped in these communities. People were made drug dependent. Number two, the people who were supposed to supply resources to the townships of America, the ghettos, if you will, they didn't actually supply those resources. So what am I talking about? The school system in New York, in Harlem, is unequal in comparison to the school system in Upper Manhattan, for instance. What does that mean? It means that you've got more and more kids who don't finish school. Now, take back that there's been a drug dependency problem that has been created by the dumping of drugs there. Number two, if you take the fact that there's an absence of parental role models because the moms are working, they're single moms effectively because the dads have been arrested. And if you go back 40 years from 1980, perhaps
the dads aren't there because there's a welfare system that gives single moms.
Oh, they've been killed, right?
Well, perhaps, yeah, but I mean, not all black fathers have been killed. I mean, even if you take that whole prison population of like a million people, that doesn't account for the other 10 million fathers who should be there.
Over a million.
That's what I'm saying. So if there are 11 million black
people
what
I'm saying
in America,
is,
then where those other fathers, I mean, they're perfectly sensible. Listen, I'm also curious about why this is happening in Democrat-controlled parts of America. Like, you don't see this happening in Republican-controlled America. It's all in Democrat cities, Democrat states, and Democrat communities. That's perhaps something that the Democrats should answer to. Why is this happening in their precincts?
Well, there's two things I want to say in response to what you just said. I've got answers for you. I'm happy to answer them. I think it's important for the listeners to hear them as well. Number one, remember, it's not everybody who commits crime. If there's a million fathers missing, Garrett, that means there's a million households where the boys in those households don't have father figures. They don't have, you know, dual income. And if the schooling system is bad for 1 million people, that may mean you're creating the necessary conditions for some of those people to pursue a life of crime.
The reason why that's a red herring. The reason why that's a red herring. It's a red herring is because if you look in terms of South African communities, and if you look in terms of black families in South Africa, how many black families in South Africa as a percentage have present fathers?
Not as many as they should. And I think that
compared to the United States,
I don't have the numbers top of my head because this is just a question we're examining now, and I'm sure we can look it up.
Fewer than a third of black kids in this country have present fathers.
And I would say to you, that's a large contributor to the reasons why we see the kind of social ills that we do. The
substance
abuse, the gender-based
violence. Right. I'm agreeing with you. But why is it systemic racism in the U.S. and not systemic racism in South Africa?
Some people would say it is systemic and structural racism, even in South Africa, because the reason why those families were separated is because people were removed from their agrarian lifestyles. They were told that they had tax and in pace to income, and that's why they started moving into the cities to work in mines, and that disrupted the African traditional household and removed those father figures who were present all year long. And then the system changed their presence from being all year long to only being present on big holidays like Easter and the December holiday. So a lot of the structural racism analysis is actually around that kind of stuff. The policy decisions that were made that created the social ills that manifest. So if people are asking, well, what does it take for this protest movement to die away, you actually need to see some commitments to structural reforms in the communities which are most adversely affected by the neglect and sometimes the deliberate denial of resources. So if you were to see funding being made available for mental health care facilities in some of the hardest hit areas in America, for proper schooling, where people have quality schooling, where they have real options for upward mobility, then you probably could see some of the people saying, we got enough. Additionally,
So, Jamie, you're saying it's
non-violent policing.
You're saying it's not good enough to just put a black square on your Instagram?
Definitely not. It's definitely not about that. And I think that's where the conversation lies, is that if we're being germane to the issues, we need to actually ask ourselves, if we are trying to achieve upward mobility for all people in America, have we created those platforms for everyone? I don't think that the answer is yes in the instance of African-American communities as well as Hispanic communities. They haven't received the resources they need in order for everyone to be able to pursue the American dream. And that's why becoming a success in those communities makes you an exception rather than the norm, which is not true in a lot of other communities which have been allocated sufficient resources, be it education, welfare, you name it.
Canton?
My entire thing from the get-go, Gareth, is that we cannot fix all the problems of the universe. We try to solve every particular problem. It's eating an elephant. It's one mouthful at a time. There was a very specific proposal that came forth from current and former staffers working for Mayor de Blasio in New York. And I'm going to tell you what their proposals were. They said, take a look at the New York Police Department's operating budget, reduce it by $1 billion in fiscal year 2021, reallocate that money to essential social services, including housing support, rental relief, food assistance, and healthcare. Immediately fire all New York Police Department officers found to have used excessive force. Release the names and official disciplinary records of all New York Police Department personnel who've been accused of using excessive force. Appoint an independent commission in the vein of the Knapp and Mullen commissions, composed of civil rights attorneys, journalists, and activists, to investigate the response of the mayor's office and the New York Police Department. Those are very specific things, which I support, because every single one of those has a specific outcome that can be directly derived from it. We can't fix systemic problems within particular communities that have been built up over generations immediately. Have those problems been reduced systematically across all of the United States? Absolutely, yes. Are there fewer people incarcerated in those communities than have ever been incarcerated before? Yes, in terms of absolute numbers. Are there more successful Black people in the United States now than at any other time in history? Absolutely, yes. That is progress that is measurable by every standard. But if we are looking specifically at the question of how we address police brutality, I am saying that there are very specific responses that we can put in place immediately. And holding police officers accountable is fundamental. Killing the power of the police unions to hold the entire policing structure in the United States hostage is, again, one of the other things that we can do. We have the same problem in this country.
I was just about to say.
Where Pop Crew has a disproportionate influence in terms of ensuring that corrupt police officers keep their jobs. These are simple things to fix. Hone in on corruption. Ensure that there's a higher degree in terms of education for the officers that one does end up hiring, and tone down the militarization and focus instead on preventative measures. I remember in the 80s when I skipped the country and I ended up spending a very brief period hopping across to the UK from the US because there were very cheap tickets available back then. And one of the things that struck me when I got into London was there was a billboard that was advertising for Bobbies on the Beat. Gareth, you might remember Bobbies on the Beat.
No.
Okay. Well, these were police officers who would basically walk the streets of the United Kingdom, and they carried truncheons, nothing else.
Yeah.
Okay. But the advertisement that was recruiting for people to be part of the UK police force showed a yobbo spitting on the face of a police officer. And the ad said, "Are you brave enough to turn the other cheek?" And the essential premise of it was that in order to be a person that was going to be recruited as a Bobby on the beat in the UK, you needed to be the type of person who was able to show restraint in terms of extreme provocation. And that needs to be the means test in terms of how we go about recruiting police officers the world over. And until we can get into the back of our minds that that is where we start by fixing the problem of police brutality and not by trying to solve problems of systemic racism, we are never going to fix this.
Well, I want to say that the Bobby on the beach standard is a good standard. And in fact, Kempton, if you were in America right now advocating for it, you probably would be labeled a Black Lives Matter activist, because a lot of people who've been calling for these things have been calling them for a very long time. It's very simple solutions when you think about it, that the reason why they haven't happened is there's been a lack of political will. But the only place I would like push back a little bit to what you said is just that I do think that you do need to address the systemic issues, because if you don't address them, you continue to have the pattern that generates the kind of confrontations that we've seen right now. You can't continue to deny people access to opportunities, dump drugs in their communities, profile them, and then not expect to see flare-ups periodically, whether it's in 1992 with those particular riots, or even now, or 2015. You're going to keep seeing those kind of things. But the other thing I want to say is that there's something that is a little bit inaccurate around the progress of African-American communities. One of the things that we've seen is that when you look at it in percentage terms, not absolute terms, you find that there are fewer people in the African-American community now with tertiary level qualifications than they were in the 60s when the civil rights era was at its peak. So
absolutely
even though,
not. Absolutely
no, you should Google
not.
It. I'll send you the link. And I encourage everyone to Google it. Here's the question. In percentage terms, have African Americans acquired more university degrees than they had in the 60s? The answer is no. So that shows that there hasn't been an increase in the amount of professionals
in percentage terms, not absolute terms. There's an overall decrease.
That's what I'm saying.
Across all people. It's not only African Americans.
But when we're measuring progress.
There are fewer people getting university degrees now because there are job opportunities that currently do not require university degrees. They require other types of qualifications. They require other types of skill sets. Entrepreneurial skills do not actually require that type of thing. But
You're right, except that when we're looking at the African American community, we also have to look at their access to quality education to begin with. So while
that may
be true, what
you have to ask is whether there's a disproportionate lack of access among African Americans, or whether there's a disproportionate lack of access among people in the United States as a whole.
I don't know if that's entirely a fair comparison to make, because we know, for example, there are African American universities where, by a degree of 80% or more, a university is only taking in students, or that is mostly taking in students that are black. There is no Hispanic.
That's what they call it.
There's no Hispanic university in America, and yet Hispanic people are performing pretty well. I mean, what's that all
well,
about?
Well, they're not performing pretty well, Garrett. The people who are performing pretty well are the Asian Americans, the European Americans, and the Jewish communities. So the Hispanics and the African Americans actually have the same problems. But looking at historically
But there are black universities, yes, yes. And there are no Hispanic universities, is my point.
I'm going to answer that. The reason why you have the historically black colleges is just because
they speak a different language when they come to America. They speak Spanish, not English.
Well, America now is a bilingual state, first and foremost. But when you're looking at historically black universities, they exist as an incident of history coming out of schools such as the one that was started by.
Yeah.
But what I want to talk about is if you look at the university level, you looked at the wrong place. You need to actually look at the pipeline from the schools to the universities. There's always going to be enough people to populate universities because they are, you know, like they have limited seats. The question
Jamie,
then
the
becomes,
pipeline is better than it's ever been at any time.
No, it's not. And this is the point I'm trying to make. If you look at the studies
last year, there's a few by New York Times. I'm about to tweet
the
link to the
American schools are more segregated
that shows that I'm
now
correct.
Than they were in 1954. And I'll send out a few links as well. I'll pass them to your producer. Is that the reasons why some people are not going to university in the suburbs of America is not the reason why people are not going to university in the ghettos of Harlem and Detroit. The reason they're not going to university in the ghettos of Harlem and Detroit is because the system has denied them access to that, not because they started a startup, you know, and not because they didn't want to go to a historically black college. It's because the pipeline is not open for them. There's no upward mobility. So why? That's why I'm saying to you, when you look at the performance of the African-American community in terms of the number of graduates and professionals that exist in those communities, which are necessary to create wealth, they're not necessarily performing the same as other communities. And part of that is because of the structural issues that we've identified. And I do agree with the policy reforms that Canton pointed out. They're actually very good. And if he stood for them, he probably would be labeled a Black Lives Matter activist in America, because you'd have to push for them. And the police and everybody else would target him the same way that they are other people making the same calls in America.
Actually, if more people in the U.S. started speaking to these specific things, you would be in a position where the problem would actually get fixed. Right now, if you have a scenario where someone actually goes to Congress and lobbies for a bipartisan approach to put in place these things in terms of fixing police forces, trust me, it will pass. But because of the fact right now that you have predominantly Democrat governments who are trying to push through this agenda that it's a racism problem and not a police brutality problem, you are still going to have this continuing to be the case.
It almost appears to me people are complaining more about the thing, and they're enjoying complaining more than they want solutions, because it's
that's exactly right.
It's like if we actually have to solve this problem, we have to look at how we can start doing that elephant chewing one piece at a time thing, which is much more work. It's much easier to protest, riot, and complain and blame someone else.
Well, the unfortunate thing is that the Democratic leadership has not really put Black issues on the agenda in the same way that other issues have been put on. And sometimes they've been given a pass because of the dynamics of, you know, even civil rights politics, and that a lot of the Black community actually is loyal to the Democratic Party. So as much as you were asking, why do these things happen so much in the Democratic-led cities, is because they've been unaddressed for very long. Unfortunately, the community leaders from African-American communities have called for these things to be promulgated and passed. There's not really been political will. Part of the reason why there's not been political will is because people take the Black vote for granted. But the other reason is because many people still harbor racist attitudes, and they don't want to release money to African-American communities, even in the progressive states. And that's one of the ironies of America, is that some of the worst forms of racism happen in the so-called progressive spaces, because those spaces actually think that they are holier than thou and that they've done all of the work that they need to do, when the reality is they haven't done as much as they should.
I mean, yeah, okay, you're saying the Democrats don't put Black issues on the agenda. It seems to me that Black issues predominate the Democrat agenda, and no more time was that more obvious than during this election, where, for example, almost everything that was controversial in any of those debates was around race. It seems that it's a preoccupation of the Democrats.
Well, that would be inaccurate, actually. You know, if you were to watch the latest interviews where Joe Biden was actually speaking to Black leadership, Charlemagne the God is one of the people that a lot of people go to interview with when they're courting Black voters. He actually asked the question to Joe Biden, do you have a Black agenda? What is that Black agenda? And Joe Biden could not articulate it except to defend himself for his position on the crime bill in the early 90s, one which actually led to more incarceration of Blacks and not less.
Famously, Joe Biden said, well, if you don't vote for me, you're not Black at the end of that.
Yes, and that was offensive and arrogant and dismissive, because the question that he's been asked,
isn't that largely the attitude of the Democratic Party, is that they see Black votes as a block vote, which is easy to get if you just pander? That's how Democrats.
The issue is that they don't actually they don't actually provide policy, which is what some people have been bringing up now, is that the black community has been voting in lock
and
stare.
Nobody's asking for policy. Look at these
protests. No one's asking.
This protest, nobody in this protest, no one is proffering ideas like Canton's talking about when it comes to policing or education.
No, they are actually. There's a lot of people making policy proposals.
Not the old guys in the civil rights movement. They're having too much fun making money out of causing racial trouble.
No, that's not true. I mean, there are a lot of policy propositions which have been made, which are on the table, which precede even Black Lives Matter.
Al Sharpton doesn't.
Yes, all of these guys, Al Sharpton,
Al Sharpton hasn't given a single policy proposal. He hasn't got time in between all his tirades to offer policy proposals. You must be joking.
Well, I think, guys, you must make the distinction between a speech that's made at a political rally and actual substantive contributions. Anybody speaking at a political rally will not sound as if they have a detailed 16-point plan, but that doesn't mean that detailed 16-point plans don't exist out there. Right. The challenge is those points have been put out there. Those agendas have been asked for by many people in the black community. One of the prominent ones who's a little bit of an entertainer is Killer Mike, who's been saying, listen, these are the things we need for Atlanta, for America to achieve the kind of reforms that we want. But the policymakers have not put that on the table. And part of it is because of the attitude that exists from some people like Joe Biden, where they can say, well, vote for me and you're black, or vote for Trump and you're not black. But the issue isn't for black people, individuals. The issue is actually who has got the kind of policy reforms which actually advance our interests as a community. And this is where I want to go back to a little bit earlier in the conversation,
but that's also,
where you asked if I support Trump.
But then you're assuming,
no, I don't.
No, but hold on. You're assuming.
But I support the policy.
You're assuming.
I support the policy that he had on prisons.
But you just said something interesting, right? You said, like, how this applies to individuals in the black community as opposed to what it does for the community as a whole. Isn't that the basis of some of the trouble here? Is that actually, you know, again, black people, there are fathers in black neighborhoods who, despite all the circumstances to the contrary, despite all the systemic problems that we've discussed, there are black fathers who are at their post, looking after their kids, doing the right thing, raising their children. They're working hard. They maybe own some of those shops that were looted this week. There are individual blacks in all parts of America who are doing extraordinary things in academic institutions, in innovation, in business. I think that those people need to be the focus of our attention for a while, because they've been doing all of this and getting zero credit for it. Because people at the other end of the scale are saying it's everybody else's fault that we aren't succeeding. And we're not paying attention to those black people who are doing wonderful things. And to me, that's deeply, deeply distressing, because those people deserve even more credit than their white compatriots for having surmounted the problems that America has very seriously got at its core. And we instead keep deferring to the lowest hanging fruit and saying, well, it's got to be these guys. And why is criminality an issue? It's almost like you're saying, you know, those guys have no option but to be criminal. That would be a racist thing to say.
Well, it's because victimology, portraying black people as victims, is an important business for most people around the world. And it's going to continue to be so until we have that mindset change.
Well, I would push back to that kind of a narrative by saying this. Professor Tawana Kupe, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Pretoria, is one of the most accomplished Zimbabwean nationals to ever exist on the continent. But you cannot use him as an example to try to explain why Zimbabweans by and large are suffering, because you need to look at the systemic issues in Zimbabwe which have created the poverty, not necessarily to look at Professor Tawana Kupe, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Pretoria, and say, well, that's an excellent Zimbabwe.
It might be more interesting to hear how he succeeded in spite of all those problems than it would be to just keep dwelling in the mire of why the others haven't.
But if you want to see more of him, you have to actually look at the administration in Zimbabwe, the oppression, the dictatorship, and the systemic collapse, because that's why you don't have, you know, an army of Professor Tawana Kupes, and you've got the exception.
Or maybe,
you don't look at that, the mess.
Or maybe we should ask Asian Americans why they outperform everyone, including white Americans, in almost every sphere. Then maybe we could discover how to improve everyone.
Well, there are
very specific things that we know in terms of how to fix things and how to become more successful. And there's a couple of boxes that we need to tick. The one is finish school. The second is don't have a kid before you get married. And the third thing is get a job, any job, no matter how menial the job may be. If you do those three things, You will end up building generational wealth.
And just I think if you look at America, black communities have not been given as much access to those options. I mean, aside from the get a baby
they
in
have,
America,
they have more access to tomorrow, now than at tomorrow. Any other time in history, and that's going to continue to
no,
be the case.
No, they've got the same problems they had in 1954 when Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and all of these guys were problematizing this. If you look
Absolutely
at the situation,
not.
What
and
you
in
say,
fact, the same, in fact, the single
that's
thing,
just, that's
in
fact, not, that the, is not true. I mean, there
no,
is
that's actually not
there,
true.
And the single thing that Trump said.
Is there any country, Jamie, is there any country in the world where it's better for black people than in America at the moment? There isn't one in Africa where it's better for black
people.
What are you
talking about? It's not better for black people in America. I would say it's better for them in the UK than it is in America, just because there's lower levels of death and slightly better access to education there. So if we were to compare the African American and the European American, European African, I think that
so
you
which
find
country?
That,
okay, would you say the UK is the best?
Like Latin, the
right,
UK
right
say,
now so, in the world, the best country to be a black person in is probably the UK. Is that right?
Well, it's better. There's still issues. But comparatively, I would say the UK and France. You're better off being black in the UK and France than you are being black in Minneapolis or in New York. But the thing is, the amount of progress that you guys think happened in African-American communities didn't actually happen. And when you do a comparative analysis, you're not actually going to see that community to have progressed
would
as
you?
Much as it looks. You can't measure them by South African standards. What, you have to measure them
to,
by the standard of their
we
community.
We have to wrap this up.
So and, that is the most racist thing that we can possibly say, because we have different standards for different communities.
No, I'm saying economic standards. You cannot use South African economic standards because everyone in the ghetto of New York maybe has an iPhone. And then you say, well, there's iPhones. That means that they're doing well. No, everyone in America has iPhones. You don't use that as a measure. You have to say, how are they doing comparative to their peers in this environment under these controlled conditions? Because, you know, even if you're poor in America, whether you live in a trailer or whatever, you can access certain things that Africans cannot access. So we can't use a third world standard to compare first world countries. So that's the point that I was making.
Would you rather, as a last question to both of you, would you rather be a person of color in South Africa in 2020? Or in America? All things considered.
I'll go with South Africa.
You'd go with South Africa. Canton?
Yeah.
The question makes no sense to me, Gareth.
Well, I'm just curious. I'm just curious because it is just a matter of geography to some people. But are the policies for a person of color in South Africa more advantageous than they are in America? I'm just saying if you had the choice to be born in a different place.
The fundamental thing for me is that it's possible for a black person to become elected president in the United States. It's impossible for a white person to be elected president in South Africa. So if you're talking in terms of equality of opportunity, my money goes with the United States any day.
All right. Thank you both
very much. I choose this country.
All right. There we go. Thank you, gents. Been good. This has been really interesting. I appreciate both of your inputs. And thank you for all the research that you did, too, on both of your parts, because there was a lot of statistical evidence offered by both sides. We will post links, and we'll hope to have you both again in the ring fighting it out, because this was very, very entertaining and interesting.
Thanks for having
Thank you. Jamie and Canton Pillay, Mighty Jamie, Canton Pillay, and our burning platform for today. Nothing boring about that. Everything looking really good. Gents, we're going to have to pose for a little photo before we all go on our way. This is The Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. Every single weekday, you can join us here on The Burning Platform to find out what's going on in the world. And we will be back next Thursday, same time, same place. Also, tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., bright and early. Cliffcentral.com